The following Dharma discourse was given by Jeffrey Shugen Arnold at Zen Mountain Monastery. Shugen Roshi is the head of the Mountains and Rivers Order and abbot of the monastery. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you would like to make a donation or find out more about our various programs, visit us online at zmm.org. Thank you for listening.
Master Zhao Zhou's Three Turning Words from the Blue Cliff Record, Part 3. Zhao Zhou expressed three turning words to his community. A gold Buddha does not pass through a furnace. A wood Buddha does not pass through fire. A mud Buddha does not pass through water. A wood Buddha does not pass through fire. Suedo's verse. A wood Buddha does not pass through fire. I always think of the oven breaker. The staff suddenly strikes, and then one realizes they turned away from their self. So this week during Sesshin, I gave a couple of talks in which we took up the mud Buddha and the gold Buddha. So in this koan, Master Zhao Zhou presents these three turning words that seem very similar. Each is a Buddha made of a different element. Each passes through or cannot pass through some element, water, fire, furnace. And the question is, why? Why can't a gold Buddha not pass through? And so in the first talk, I looked a little bit at this sort of sense of passing through that comes up a lot in the teachings. In birth, nothing is born. In death, nothing dies. In arriving, no one actually, no being appears. In departing, no being leaves. What is that pointing to? And in each of these, related to each of these Buddhas, Zhao Zhou has presented, or Zuedo created a different verse, capping verse. And in each of those, he invokes a story from the Zen tradition. And I'll speak briefly about those and then focus on this oven breaker. A Buddha has no fixed form. There's a gold one, a wooden one, one made out of clay. Compassion has no fixed form. Wisdom has no fixed form. Skillful means has no fixed form. A monastery, zazen, liturgy, has no fixed form. And because of that, it can take a multitude of forms. And so we practice within certain practice traditions, forms of sitting and liturgy and making up a community, practicing Sesshin. All of these are practice forms that have come down to us through the bodies and minds of practitioners just like us in their own time and place. Because they have no fixed form, they can convey the Dharma, they can offer passage, they can appear as obstructions. None of those elements are within the form itself. But when we encounter it, we encounter that in our mind. And so it's almost certain, in fact, it kind of has to be. If it isn't, then we're failing, that there are certain elements of practice that you're not going to like, that you may feel resistant to, you may not understand. If a student is not experiencing any challenge within practice, either they don't need to practice or they're not practicing. And it's not because a challenge is somehow inherently spiritual or noble, or you get rewarded, right? It's not that. It's that when we meet the challenge, we're encountering our mind. Something about ourselves, my mind, the way I see things, the way I respond to things, is being brought up in this moment with this usually very simple encounter. When we were getting ready to do Dokusan this morning, Gikan, who was a Jisha this week, asked, should he light the abbot incense? I said, yes, and we did our bows, and then I said, do you know why it's called that? He said, no, and I said, well, Dada Roshi, used the sandalwood incense because he liked it. And so we would, when somebody was being trained, they would say, well, use the incense that the abbot likes, right? This is what Roshi likes, so use that incense. It's the abbot's incense. It's the abbot incense. And so it became a descriptor, and then it became a noun, right? And it's not known as that, I think, anywhere else in the world, right? And so when he died, I continued to use it, one, because we had a bunch of it, and two, because I liked it, but more importantly, because it brought him into the room. It brought him into my mind, because I had such a strong association with the smell of that particular incense, because he burned it when he was giving a talk, or when he would come in and start morning zazen, or when he would be doing doksan. And so it brought him to life again for me. And so when I pass on, or the next abbot, they will have a decisive moment where they continue that tradition or risk great peril by choosing a different kind of incense. But that's how things start, right? And in a way, it's simple, it's innocuous, but it's how traditions start. You know, I imagine most of the traditions that have been handed down, you know, have reasoning behind them. Why do we begin a period with three strikes on the bancho, right? Why not two? Why not four? Numbers have been important in many cultures and many religions since antiquity. They have meaning. They're given meaning. So here we have these different Buddhas. Buddha is an awakened being. A Buddha is your mind. It's your nature. It's what we realize. It has no fixed form. There's an interesting story. I've said a little bit about Zhao Zhou in previous talks. He was one of the very important teachers in our lineage. He lived for 120 years. He studied for about 100 years, really. He was in the Dharma because he came to it young. And he's very well known within the Zen tradition. There are many koans and anecdotes. He seemed to really love the faith mind. There are quite a number of both koans and just in the records of his teachings, many references to the faith lines in the faith mind. So clearly he was drawing on that. But there, it's said that when he was 80, he took up residence in Chao province, which was close to a very famous stone bridge. And so he took on the name Zhao Zhou, which was the name of the area. That became his name. And it said he emulated, this is when he was 80, emulated the ancient masters, even though he became worn out and haggard in his old age. The monk's hall had no planks, that's this hall, had no planks on the front or back. The midday meal was barely provided for. When one of the legs of his chair broke, he simply tied a piece of burned firewood to it. Once there was someone who wished to make, you'd like that. And then you would use it to paint something beautiful. It says, once there was someone who wished to make a new leg for the chair, but he would not permit it. He was a resident priest for 40 years and never once was a letter sent asking for support from the laity. You know, these stories come down and we don't know actually the actual truth of what was going on, but they come from somewhere. But more importantly, they're conveying something. So what is this conveying about Zhao Zhou? What was important to him? Where did he want, not just him, but all of his students to be putting their attention? What did he not want them to be getting too caught up in? It's a way of just sort of demonstrating, you know, this person's dedication to the Dharma, their sense of what was important and how to keep that very present and centered, not only his awareness, but the awareness of the whole community, because everybody who was practicing with Zhao Zhou was practicing within that mind state, right? And was practicing within those sort of bare qualities, which means it wasn't made, he wasn't going out of his way to make it comfortable, right? And so when something isn't comfortable and you're doing it and you have a choice, then the question comes, well, why am I doing this? Why am I, you know, experiencing or subjecting myself to this discomfort when I don't have to? Is there something that's more important than being comfortable? Can I practice this in such a way that my present experience of discomfort in my mind is transformed? One day Zhaozhou was teaching, well, in the mondo from which this comes, he said, metal Buddhas, gold Buddhas can't pass through a furnace, wood Buddhas can't pass through fire, a mud Buddha can't pass through water. The true Buddha sits within. And Zuedo in the commentary to this said that that was exceedingly indulgent, so he didn't include it in the koan. He thought that was too much, saying too much. And he goes on to say, Zhaozhou, Bodhi, Nirvana, suchness, Buddha nature, they're just clothes stuck on the body and are such, and as such are to be called compulsive passions. They're very important terms in Buddhism. They have no inherent form. They have no fixed form. We give them meaning as upaya, but they can become like stuck clothes to the body when we cling to them, right? Which is the nature of any form, particularly a religious form. The form itself becomes inherently sacred, and in that way it becomes precious in a way that isn't sacred, right? Isn't just an object worthy of our veneration like the 10,000 things, but is held up as having some power of its own. That's how dogmas are born. That's how we become attached to things. We just transfer our attachments from one thing to another. It's how religions go to war. Who's got the best stuff? Zhaozhou said, to hold on to the self is to taint the self. To not hold on is to let it be purified. It's just like a mad dog who's always trying to get more and more to eat. Where is the Buddha to be found? Thousands, ten thousands of people are roaming the countryside seeking for Buddha. If you try to find one person of the way among them, you won't. If you want to become a disciple of the Buddha, don't give illness to your mind. Don't sicken your mind with the attachment, the idea of something outside of yourself that's going to save you, of something outside that has inherent worth and meaning, of something that will deliver you. And so, to bring this home, Zhaozhou says, a wood Buddha will not pass through fire. Why? To attach to Buddha, Dada Rush used to say, we can be attached to our car or our home or our clothing or our looks, and then we come in and we just now transfer our attachments to incense and to robes and to being a practitioner. As though there is something inherently, intrinsically special or spiritual or better. And so Zhaozhou is likening that to sort of a self-induced sickness. And so we practice this exquisite middle path where we honor, we practice meticulously, mindfully, with reverence, with respect, those things that we engage in, right? The form. So we take care of the sendha, we bow to our seat, right? There are people who are assigned to take care of different aspects of the altar. And for many people, I know for me, it was the first experience of sort of being in a realm that was identified as somehow being sacred. I didn't really know what that meant. I was both drawn and wary, but now I was moving in close. And because it was sort of endowed with that sense by virtue of this, it raised questions for me. There was a kind of poignancy, a sort of alertness in my mind. Well, what is this anyway? Because I wasn't interested in just, you know, attaching to it. I was wary of it for exactly that reason. He said, it's like a mad dog always trying to get more and more. The Buddha said, that will never end. That dog will never have enough, right? And that path will never succeed towards any ultimate sense of peace or satisfaction or contentment or happiness or service. And it will continue until that cycle is broken, until it is interrupted. And so we are here to practice to interrupt those cycles that are not serving us, that are not serving others, to realize that we are not at the mercy of the world or the things in our life, small and large, near and far, and there are forces in the world that do great harm. Both of those are true. We are not at its mercy, and there are forces and people and agents and groups and governments that have, are, and will likely continue to do great harm. And while we are not without influence, we are not in control of much of that. And so Zhao Zhou says, he says, when the world was not, before all of this, there was still this fundamental reality. We call it Buddha nature. We call it self nature. We call it emptiness. When the world is destroyed, this reality will still be here. It is not destroyed. It is not born. It does not die. You cannot corrupt it. You cannot buy it. You cannot sell it. You cannot make money off of it. You can make money off of deceiving people that you are somehow selling them some it, but you are not. He says, take one look at me, himself. I am nothing other than I am. The true self is just like this. Right here, what more is there for you to seek? At such a time, don't turn your head away or change your expression. If you do so, it is immediately lost. Don't turn your head or change your expression. In other words, don't run away. There's a sutra where the Buddha said, when he was out, before he was enlightened, he was practicing alone in the woods. And he said that when he was gripped by some emotion, for instance, fear, that whatever posture he was in, he would stay in that posture until he saw that open up, shift, drop away. In other words, he did not turn his head. He did not change his expression in the sense of his embodied posture. He stayed right there within it, right, to turn towards it, to see what it really is. And so while we are not at the mercy of the world, and yet there is so much in the world that causes so much harm, both are true. What the Buddha realized is the suffering that Buddhism is addressing is in our minds. That the only suffering we experience is in our minds. And that's a very, in almost alarming statement, right? Because it seems to somehow negate everything that's, all the bad actions and actors that are going on in the world. Like, it's not about that, it's just your mind. But that's just another dualistic way of looking at it. Everything that we experience, that we perceive, that we encounter, we experience. And through what the Buddha called a process of dependent arising, our mind gives rise to our perception. And then we do something with that perception. We like it, we don't like it, we push it away, we grab onto it, and therein we cause our distress, our fear, our anxiety, our discontent. And this has always been true. This is just, I remember in an introductory weekend, somebody once said, I was talking about compassion, and they say, you know what, I have the most compassionate grandmother. She's amazing, she's so kind, she's so gentle, is she deluded? And I said, probably. In the best way. Delusion isn't a mistake. Being deluded doesn't mean we can't be kind. If that was true, we wouldn't be here. It means we don't see things clearly. And depending on how clearly we do not see things, or how unclearly we do see things, how much in the grips of our overwhelming emotions, the conditions of our life, lots of different factors. We think, we speak, and we act. And on the basis of that, we can bring forth kindness and compassion, even in trying times, or we can wreak havoc when we have everything we need and more. And the Buddha said, very simply, it just doesn't have to be like that. It's our mind. And so the sense of, we are not trying to, I thought, well, we're not trying to tame, you know, because oftentimes it's presented as, well, you know, to tame the mind, to subdue the mind, to vanquish, right, to constrain our delusions, our kleshas, right? And I thought, it's just so difficult to find a word that actually matches what we're doing that doesn't have some sense of force or aggression, right? Like, is that all we are? Is that the only way we know how to go about something? Because it's really none of those things. And yet it has elements. And so we sit, you know, I said earlier in the week, you know, to bring it down to the basics. There's you on this cushion. Sit, breathe, and see. Now, what do you see? You are nothing other than you. That's what Zhao Zhou said. It is nothing other than it. This is entirely this. That is entirely that. When we look deeper, we realize your nature and the nature of this or that, same. Same nature. There's only one nature that is the nature of all things. We call it emptiness. We call it radiance. We call it liberation. And Zhao Zhou says, what more could be sought? It's not outside. You will never find it outside. No one can give it to you. This is the stark and good news, right? Why is it good news? Because you don't have to wait. You don't have to go find that person, right? Be in that place, in that perfect setting, at that right time. It also means you're never going to get away from it. But of course, our habit mind, our conditioned mind disagrees. It's not contented, and so it goes looking for something to find contentment. And so to help us, Zhao Zhou said, it would, but it does not pass through fire. If we don't train within the fire, so there's that image, the lotus in the fire, this gorgeous, beautiful, exquisite flower. I mean, kind of as close to perfect as you could imagine when you see a lotus. It's just exquisite. And it grows out of this very murky, muddy sediment on the bottom. And so that's a metaphor, right, for how we come out of sort of arising from all of our troubles. We realize this perfect mind, body, heart, nature. And if we don't train through the fire, in other words, we can't just skip over, right? We have to actually practice the obstacles, our impediments, the very things that brought us into practice. If we don't do that, then all of that remains and remains powerful. But if we try to burn it away or vanquish it or subdue it, then we're just adding more that is unnecessary. How do we pass through? What is that? There was a buffalo, an old master said. Think of one of these tiny little windows. Huge head, bulky torso, legs. They all went through, but the tiny little tail won't pass through. Why? And the poem says, if it does pass through, it'll fall into a ditch. If it doesn't, it's destroyed. Pass through, don't pass through. Either way, something's not right. Sanchen once said, asked his Dharma brother, what does the golden fish, the enlightened fish that has passed through the net, what do they use for food? What do they feed on now that they're enlightened? And Xuefeng said, when you pass through, I'll tell you. And he was pointing directly, what is passing through? Who is this person that needs to pass through? What is that? Another master cited a sutra where there's a great bodhisattva named Wisdom Excellence Bodhisattva, Buddha, who sat for countless eons, which is a time you don't even want to count. It's so long. Who did not attain Buddhahood, who did not pass through. And the student says, why? They sat all this time. Why didn't they attain Buddhahood? And the teacher said, because they did not. What are these teachers pointing to? Why aren't they just telling us like it is? Right? Why don't they just explain it? I want to know. Just tell me. Why all of this crazy talk? Because if they explained it to us, that would be like clothes stuck to our skin. Oh, I get it. Now I know. Thank you very much. I came, I conquered, I leave. Right? And nothing would have changed. I would have added one little conversation to my mind. I would have maybe built up a little bit of pride. But my life would be exactly the same. And so these teachers convey what is inexpressible in such a way that we have to enter. Shon talked about the, Hadarashi used to talk about the Enso, this sort of eternal symbol, wholeness, completeness in Buddhism, enlightenment, the Enso. And that, like as you look downstairs, it doesn't quite meet, the head doesn't quite meet the tail. It's not, usually not ever finished, completed. You have to enter into it to complete it. That's what the teachers are doing. They're conveying just enough that you're like, what? If you want to know. And some people will just say, well, this is just ridiculous. Right? So they don't have an affinity. They're not drawn. It's not time. And so Zuedo brings up the oven breaker as what he cites to talk about this wood Buddha that will not pass through. And it's important to understand, for those newer to Buddhism, that this is a path, right? So we're traveling on a path. That means you start somewhere and you're moving. That's what a path does. It conveys you. You convey yourself. That there's a sense of crossing over to the other shore from delusion to enlightenment. Right? So there are all of these images where that's invoked, that's used, the sense of passing, crossing. So why won't these Buddhas pass through? So the oven breaker lived on a mountain and was not known by any other name. His speech and behavior were unfathomable. He dwelt in seclusion. And one day he led a group of followers among the native people of that mountain. And they had a shrine which was most sacred to them. And the only thing in the shrine was an oven. That's all there was. And people from far and near would sacrifice to it unceasingly. They immolated very many living creatures in the shrine, this oven, this place of sacredness for the people who lived on this mountain. And so the oven breaker came there and saw the shrine and tapped on it three times with his staff. And he said, what humbug, speaking to the oven, and said, you were originally made of brick and mud compounded. Where does the spirit come from? Whence does the sanctity originate that you burn living creatures to death like this? And then he struck it again. And in that moment, it collapsed and broke. And out came this tall figure, blue, with a robe and a tall hat, standing in front of the master. And they bowed and said, I am the god of this oven, and for a long time I've been subject to retribution for harmful actions in my past. But today, Hearing you explain the truth of non-origination, I am freed from this place and am already living in a Buddha land. I have come especially here to offer my thanks. And the oven breaker said, it is your fundamentally inherent nature, not my force saying so, that did this. And at that, the god disappeared. An attendant standing right there said, what shortcut did the oven god find that they were immediately born in heaven? Well, some things never change. Who doesn't want a shortcut? Where does the spirit come from? Whence does the sanctity originate that you burn living creatures like this? Who gives you the right to do this? By what spirit? From what understanding? What are you doing with this life that you burn these living creatures like this? The Buddha realized that we are born into this world with three great powers of influence. We think, we speak, and we act. And with those forces, we change, and more than change, create the world that we know, and we change and influence others, and the earth, and everything that we come into contact with. These are the ways in which we create karma. Karma is volitional action, intentional action. It comes from somewhere. I want something. Right? I can want to be the best. I can want to have the most money. I can want to beat you no matter what you're doing. I can want to be in control. I can want to heal. I can want to teach. I can want to support. I can want to do something that is good. And the basis of that becomes the consequence, becomes my world and your world. And we're doing that all within this highly intelligent, highly evolved world of nested, complex systems. I talked this morning about just the human body, just the human body. How much of its inner workings are humming along right now, and we don't even know? We don't have to know. That's how intelligent it is. I mean, it's saying, don't know, don't get involved, right? You just tend to screw things up. All finding balance in mutual existence, when balance becomes unbalanced, it tries to regain that balance. It tries to restore its balance. It's self-intelligent, self-organizing. It's evolved to do that. We are that. We're immersed in such a world. And we have this capacity to really mess things up for everyone. And it starts at home. And the Buddha said, that's why we have to start at home. That's why we come here and sit. Right? Sometimes people, you know, want to know when we're chanting, you know, why aren't we, you know, sort of engaging in each other, looking up, you know, enjoying each other's company and so on. You know, as it is in other traditions where the singing or the chanting is joyous and is sort of lifting up, right? And in a very sort of almost social way, bringing everybody together. It's a different kind of practice, right? It's a meditative practice. It's very grounding. The mukugyo, dum, dum. We are in intimate contact with each other in a different way. In a few minutes, we'll have lunch. That's where we engage in that very important part of how to create a virtue of harmony, which is Sangha. That's more familiar and still sometimes tough. But here we're learning how can you be going inward and not cut anybody out. How can you include everyone and not turn away from yourself? And so I think of that nested, interrelated, interdependent, Indra's net, It's different descriptions, ways of talking about it, as a sacred trust, that everything that exists, exists within a sacred trust. Most of the world doesn't have to think about that, right? It just does it. That's what it's built to do. That's what its nature is, to do that. And when that gets violated, it has to be restored somehow. Just being alive and intermingling means we're affecting each other. We're affecting each other this morning. That's why it's so important. And it's wonderful to have all of you here at home. And in that way, over that distance, you're being influenced. And because we are ultimately primitive beings, right? Human nature hasn't really changed. Primitive in the sense of ancient. You know, we like to think of ourselves as like thoroughly modern. But really, I mean, how can these teachings from so long ago be so incredibly contemporary? Prescient in terms of speaking to the exact reality that we find ourselves in. Because that nature is universal. And so we are affecting each other. You can't opt out of that. It's not a choice, right? So then the question becomes, how? How am I affecting? How am I affecting myself? How affecting you? How am I changing the world? And then I was thinking, how much more so with the responsibilities that we have? Responsibility of owning a home, giving birth to a child, having a family, being a school teacher, building a house, designing a bridge. I was thinking the other day as I was going over a bridge, I think, who would have the mojo to think, I can design a bridge that countless people are going to drive over and their lives are going to depend on you knowing what you're doing? That takes a certain amount of chutzpah, right? And skill, and, you know, we hope, and training, and oversight, and all the stuff. But even more so when we have responsibilities. A mechanic, a dentist, we trust them to know what they're doing, right? A sacred trust that when we come here, when I came here, and I gained trust in my teacher, that trust was, I trust that you know what you're doing. You are guiding me. I'm looking to you for guidance. But I knew that in my trusting him, I wasn't just trusting him, this person, of what he's learned in this lifetime, but I was trusting a lineage that went back hundreds and hundreds of years, in which that had been verified and held accountable. So what gives you the right to burn these living creatures? And he tapped the oven again, and it broke and freed. And then he came back to offer thanks, the god did. And the oven breaker said, it's not my saying so that released you. It's your basic nature. But the oven breaker did tap the oven. This god was trapped in the oven, caught in a cycle of grief as a result of past actions. At that moment, the conditions were right, collapsed, liberated. Where does the spirit come from that you do this? It's like when the Buddha gave a talk one day and he said, look, you're in a burning house. The house is burning. What is it that's burning? Your eyes. Your consciousness, the objects that you see, your ears, your consciousness, the sounds that you hear, all burning with self-clinging, with craving, with greed, with pride, with fear, the things that we can tether ourselves to, that we can free ourselves from. I would have liked to have been at that particular talk. Right? Can you imagine the startling starkness of that? You'd have to be dead not to be brought into attention. So we have to see that we're confined. like some encounter with dukkha, with our dissatisfaction. But there's more. Lots of people have a sense of their dissatisfaction. We have to want to be released from it. But there's more. We have to go seeking for a way, and a way that is trustworthy, and we have to find it. But there's more. We have to trust in the guides, the path itself, the forms of that path. But there's more. We have to engage it. All of those things, you could be walk into a room and the most exquisite meal could be set, and there's a table and a chair and there's a name plaque and it's yours. And there's somebody waiting to seat you. You have to sit. And we have to eat. And so this attendant said, what shortcut did this God find that they were immediately born into heaven? There is urgency. So I get the shortcut. Who doesn't want a shortcut? Who doesn't want to think that what we're doing is the most effective way for us to me to be doing this? Right? So you want a shortcut? This is it. You got it. And it can't be rushed. And so the training helps to cultivate a sense of urgency. Don't go to sleep, right? This day is already past, already moving, right? How many more do you have? The actual answer, you don't know. You don't know. I don't know. There's a reason why Buddhism brings that question to our mind. There's a reason why it's a good practice to bring that question to our mind, to your mind, on a regular basis. Not to be fearful, but to be emboldened, to be motivated. And so what was that shortcut that the God had? And the master said, I just said you originally made of brick and mud. Where does the spirit come from? Whence does the sanctity emerge? And the attendant had nothing to say, didn't know what to say. And the master said, do you understand? And the student said, no, I don't understand. And the master said, bow. And right as the student was bowing, the oven breaker said, broken, collapsed. And at that, the monk had an insight. He bowed. Broken, collapsed. What is that? We've all done bows this morning. That student's mind was ripe. And he was in the presence of some skillful hands. And so we practice to embody, to make real our fundamental wisdom and compassion today. So if we want to live compassionate lives, it means we actually be compassionate in this moment, and in this moment, and then in this moment, right? And every Buddhist practitioner signs it wants that, and then begins to see, oh, that's hard. I was talking to a student who said that they made a vow to themselves of just being kind. And then they said, it's hard. When we're honest. Why can't the wood Buddha pass through? For the koan student, you have to be the wood Buddha. In the fire. Not as an idea, not as a metaphor, not as sweet poetry, not as clever thinking and talking, but in a live way, like your life depends upon it. You know, in the Zen tradition, sometimes we say, practice like your head is on fire. That actually goes back to the Buddha. There are sutras where the Buddha said, if your turban is on fire, how will you respond? Without hesitation, right? And so, when we engage in the path and seek to cross over, seek to pass through, seek to free ourselves, we discover, ultimately, that we haven't taken a single step. We haven't left anywhere. We haven't arrived anywhere. But those are not just words. It's a lived experience. And further than that, we realize that every single person, even the craziest, most warmongering person, the most selfish person, is like that. The further away we get from that, the more suffering we create. It just seems to be clear in the evidence. It's as though the more we dilute it, that delusion is actually like a poison, right? When it's mild, it's a mild poison. And so we experience it as unhappiness and discontent and, you know, all kinds of emotions. We learn to live with them. We kind of get by. We do the best we can, try and have good things. It works. Sometimes it works enough forever. Sometimes it works enough and then it doesn't. And we begin to seek. But when that becomes more and more, the toxicity becomes more and more. Like literally, right? And we can't contain it. And so we act out. And so we see, tragically, heartbreakingly, right? People who are acting out their delusion in ways that we should be able to identify in our own smaller, I hope, kinder ways. And it's just their mind. That's how powerful it is. That's why the Buddha said, right? This life is precious. We embody, we carry something within us that is more powerful than we know. So, what will we do with all of this? I'll end with a poem. Mud Buddha, Gold Buddha, Wood Buddha, no one's life turns out as planned. Set that plan free. Enter the fire, meet the dog, collapse the oven. Good gracious, I'm already exhausted. This staff, now, what is it? The staff that the oven breaker held. Zuedo says, the staff suddenly strikes, and then one realizes they turned away from the self. And then he says, who has this staff? And then he says, who doesn't have it? And so this staff, now, what is it? What is this staff? Oh, yes. Oh, yes. 1,000 times, 1,000 worlds. Yes.
Thank you for listening. To find out more about ZMM's programs, retreats, and residency, please visit us online at zmm.org.